Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. 26 years after he completed his presidency, Ronald Reagan continues to inform American discourse. In certain circles, his name is invoked with nothing short of reverence as a bastion of principled conservatism, while in others, the name Reagan is synonymous with a sort of disingenuous populism that opened the door to more benefits for the wealthy and fewer for the needy and middle class. Whether one embraces or rejects his messages, it's hard to disagree that Reagan was a gifted communicator. And as my guest will tell us, a close study of his life demonstrates he was both more and less than either his greatest fans or detractors might realize. H.W. Brands is Jack S. Blanton, Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is Reagan, The Life. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church. The event is part of the Authors Live Speaker Series. Bill, welcome back to Think.
Delighted to be with you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So Reagan had good looks and intelligence from the very start. Nobody could say he lived a charmed existence as a very young person, but he did learn to use charm and to use humor to win people over.
Reagan learned at a very early age that getting people to laugh, getting people to applaud you was one of the ways of lifting life's anxieties. He had a tough childhood. His father was an alcoholic, and it left the Reagan household as a unit, and Ronald Reagan himself specifically, always uneasy, uncertain as to, well, which father was going to, they're going to have to deal with that day. Was the drunk father or the one who was Reagan's best friend and good buddy and told him how to tell good stories? And so Reagan recalls, he wrote actually two memoirs, one just as he was going into politics in California in the mid-60s, and then one after he left the White House, and it was published in the early 1990s. In both of these, he talks about how the applause of audiences was something that really caused him to feel as though this is the place that I'm safe. I'm not safe at home, but I'm safe here. And the attraction of the stage drew him forward throughout his entire life. First, he went into school plays in high school, and then college plays. He went into radio. He eventually went into Hollywood and then television. And as his film and TV careers were kind of fading out, he found a new stage, politics, and it was the biggest stage of all.
Was he political from an early age, or was this something that developed over time?
No, it's one of the striking things to me as his biographer. You know, it's natural when you choose a subject who became this world figure, as Reagan did. And, of course, it's tempting to think that the man who accomplished this stuff that he did in his maturity, in Reagan's case, in his 70s, there are hints to that. The secret of the mature Reagan is there in Reagan the boy. But you just don't see it. In fact, Reagan hardly had any political ambitions before he was in his early 50s. He turned to politics because everything else he had turned his hand to was turning sour. He was in middle age, and the things to which he had devoted his life, namely movies and TV, were that part of his career was going away, and he didn't know what the next act was going to be. And then he was given an opportunity to speak on behalf of Barry Goldwater, the Republican nominee in 1964. And he gave local speeches that were well-received. And so some people around California thought, well, how about we put him on national TV? We'll buy some airtime. And it's not going to resuscitate the Goldwater campaign, but it's going to, well, one of the things it's going to do is help the Goldwater campaign balance the books. They were deeply in debt. So this Reagan speech that was televised was largely a fundraising event. But people saw the speech, and they said, this guy is really good. And this is a remarkable thing. A week before Reagan gave that speech, almost no one thought of Ronald Reagan and politics in the same sentence. The day after the speech, it was so good that Ronald Reagan for president committees were being formed around the country. And all sorts of Republicans turned off their TVs after Reagan gave that speech and said, oh, my gosh, we've nominated the wrong guy. If we had nominated this man, we might have a chance of winning. And that's how Reagan's political career got started. But you just don't see that. He was not a political being in his earlier years. Briefly, when he was in Hollywood as head of the Screen Actors Guild, he had to address the question of communists in Hollywood. But if you had asked him his position on taxation, his position on foreign policy, his position on any number of other things, he probably would have just drawn a blank.
I realize you're not an art critic, but I'm just going to ask you, was Ronald Reagan a good actor?
Ronald Reagan was good enough to get a foothold in politics, but not good enough to make it to the top of the marquee. If he had been a better actor, he never would have gone into politics. And the reason he was not a good actor was not a better actor than he was also one of the reasons that he was successful in politics. And it had to do with the emotional reserve that Reagan approached life with, in part because of the uncertainties of growing up with his alcoholic father. He never really let down his emotional defenses. And for that reason, he wasn't able to play those really dramatic roles where the actor has to dig really deep into some emotional well. Reagan just wouldn't go there. And so when Reagan announced that he was going to run for California governor, Samuel Goldwyn, who was a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, he articulated a common view, and Goldwyn said, no, Jimmy Stewart for governor, Ronald Reagan for best friend. He was a really good actor playing the lead's best friend.
But he was good enough for a long time to sell things like GE appliances and soap. I just want to play a little bit of this is Ronald Reagan for Boraxo.
Here's great news about two wonderful Boraxo hand cleaning products. First, Boraxo powdered hand soap in a new plastic decorated container. Looks like this on the grocer's shelf, and like this on your bathroom or kitchen sink. Perfect for everyday hand washing. Boraxo washes hands cleaner and faster than bar soaps can. And here's exciting new Boraxo.
You hear that, and on the one hand, it's great, and on the other hand, it sort of makes you cringe that the leader of the free world was, shilling soap.
Well, this was exactly it. So Reagan had had these dreams of being the next Clark Gable. Well, that didn't quite pan out. And then, in fact, his career, his movie career faded away. He went into the politics of the film business. But after a while, he couldn't get any decent roles. And so then he went into television, which was in the 1950s was a big demotion.
There was no HBO to make it cool.
No, not at all. Yeah, exactly. And he had a gig with General Electric, and he was their shill basically for 8 years. And he hosted the GE Theater, which meant people would see his face for 3 minutes at the beginning of a show on Sunday night. But the rest of the time, he was touring the country, visiting GE plants and talking to employees and talking to Rotary clubs and chambers of commerce and saying what a great thing GE and big business were. And then he even lost that job. And what the listeners just heard was when he was host of Death Valley Days, which was brought to the country by 20 Mule Team Borax. And so here's this guy who had these great hopes, and now he's basically doing infomercials. And that was his last job before he went into politics and became governor of California and then president of the United States. It was a remarkable turnaround and remarkably late in this guy's life.
It wouldn't seem fair to argue that once he got the jobs in politics as California governor and certainly as president, that he wasn't interested in doing a good job. But is it fair to call him an opportunist? Like, if something else had fallen in his lap, could he just as easily have made a different career turn?
If somebody had offered him the CEO position at some major corporation, he would have been just as happy going that way. And he was looking for a new avenue for his energies. He was a healthy guy. He had ideas. He had stuff he wanted to do. But he didn't have that political passion that you often identify in people who do rise to the top of politics. So yes, indeed, if he had been offered to be the head guy at 20 Mule Team Borax, he probably would have taken that job and would have been quite happy.
It's easy to forget this now. Reagan started his life voting as a Democrat. And in fact, I love this detail. As a young man in radio, he would listen really carefully to FDR's fireside chats and be inspired by that communication style.
One of the things that Reagan discovered as a young man, he was in college and just graduated from college when FDR became president. He came to realize the power of political communication and the importance of being able to exploit the predominant medium of your day. So with FDR, it was radio. And people who listen to Franklin Roosevelt give his fireside chats, I still occasionally run into people who hear this, and they would say it was this voice of reassurance, because there is something about radio that, in fact, is even more intimate than, say, television. I mean, television, like movies, shows too much. With radio, it's just that voice. And 75 million Americans could listen to FDR on the radio and think that he was speaking to them alone. And it was this voice that conveyed a sense of calm and confidence. Even though the country is at the bottom of this depression, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. said Franklin Roosevelt. And he made Americans believe that. And Reagan was not thinking politically at that time. But when he did go into politics, that was the principal attitude and approach that he conveyed, that as difficult as things are during the 1960s, when there was the turbulence, the riots in the cities and the Vietnam War and all the other stuff, in the 1970s, when the economy was suffering from high inflation, high unemployment at the same time, Reagan was able to convey, now in his case, by using television, the predominant medium of that age, that America's best days were ahead of it. What Reagan understood was a president who can channel the vision of the American people, who can get the energy of the American people, is one who can accomplish almost anything.
What's fascinating about him giving us all the message that America's best days were still ahead is the fact that the Reagan that you give us is a guy who frequently said one thing publicly, communicated one idea publicly, and then behind closed doors was working to do something very different. We forget that he cut taxes, but he also raised taxes. And of course, he was talking a lot about, you know, a rather bombastic message about the Soviet Union during the end of the Cold War while he was secretly working behind closed doors to de-escalate that.
Reagan understood that one of the secrets of success in politics is the ability to say one thing and do something else, or more precisely, to say one thing, to present your maximum agenda. This is what I would do if I could have everything I wanted, but not be bound by that. Know that progress comes in steps and that you never get everything you want at once. Reagan used to say that he would rather get 80% of what he wanted than go over the cliff with his flags flying. Reagan understood the point of getting elected was to govern, and the point of governing is to make progress toward your goals. You're not going to get everything at once, but if you can get half of what you want, if you can get 80% of what you want, it's been a really good day. Take that and go to the bank. You can always come back and try to get the rest later.
So do you think he actually believed America's best days were in front of it?
I think he believed it despite evidence suggesting otherwise. And Reagan was one of these people, and I see it again and again in politics, but in other areas of life, people who I would say compartmentalize their minds. So there's the intellectual side of what they know, and then there's the emotional side of what they believe and what they want to believe. I spoke to Ron Reagan, Ronald Reagan's son, in doing the research for the book, and he talked about how his father really wanted to believe that America was the greatest country in world history and essentially had never done anything wrong, was always on the side of right and justice. And Ron said that when he was a teenager, he would sometimes poke his dad on this. He talked about how they were watching a Western movie one day, and the Indians were getting beaten up on the way they usually were. And Ron asked his dad, "Well, Dad, you know, you think that America never does anything wrong. Didn't the Indians really get the short end of the stick?" And he said his dad was really uncomfortable by that. And it's as though he didn't want to believe that. Even though he knew it, he didn't want to believe it. And Ron elaborated on this. He said, you know, my dad knew that there was slavery in the United States, and for 300 years it was perfectly legal. And my dad didn't think that slavery was right. But somehow he would say that that didn't go to the essence of what it meant to be American. Now, that might be of historical interest only, but when I was doing the research for Reagan on the Iran-Contra scandal, it's really interesting when I read Reagan's diary, and I'm the first biographer who's been able to use the diary in any kind of broad way. You can see Reagan writing entries indicating that he knows that the Iran-Contra business is arms for hostages, because he'll say, we're going to send to Tehran a new shipment of anti-tank missiles, and they will arrange the release of two more American hostages. And he shows this again and again. But when the Iran-Contra story breaks, Reagan goes on TV, and with a perfectly straight face, and I think perfectly sincerely, I don't think he's acting at this point, perfect sincerity, he says this was not arms for hostages. Now, there was the fig leaf of separation. The weapons were going to Tehran, and the hostages were held in Lebanon by people who owe their existence.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is H.W. Brands. We're talking about his new book, Reagan, The Life. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He is Jack S. Blanton, Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new biography, Reagan, The Life. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church. The event is part of the Authors Live Speaker Series. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Bill, we have Ronald Reagan on television saying it was not a trade of arms for hostages in the Iran-Contra scandal or the Iran-Contra events. How did he justify this in his mind?
It's a really good question, because if anyone else, if one of Reagan's political rivals had said this, he'd say, this is ludicrous. The man is clearly lying. I don't think Reagan thought he was lying. As I was saying, he did have a little bit of separation between the people who were actually receiving the missiles, the government of Iran, and Hezbollah, the group that was holding the hostages in Lebanon. So he could say, well, the hostage holders weren't getting the arms. But that was a very thin disguise, and he would have dismissed if anybody else had used it. But there was in Reagan this need to believe that America was always doing the right thing, because somehow it was essential to his understanding of the world. And it was exceedingly powerful because Reagan flattered the American people when he would say, we are the greatest country on earth. And who doesn't want to hear that, especially after the 1960s and 1970s, which were pretty hard on America's self-conception. And Jimmy Carter was known for giving the infamous malaise speech. He didn't use the word malaise, but he did basically say that America's troubles come from within, and we all need to look at ourselves and really do some soul searching. And Reagan comes along and says, no, we don't have to do any soul searching. We're the greatest country around, and our best days are ahead of us, and you know, our problems come from without. So there was in Reagan this, I will call it straightforward, I could call it simple or a simplistic version, view of American history and America's place in the world. But very often, the most powerful visions are the ones that simplify. And if you try to find or elaborate on the complexities of life, then you're always seeing on one hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, you never get anywhere. So Reagan didn't deal in that realm. Reagan was not an intellectual in the sense who valued ideas for the sake of ideas and who liked to debate for the sake of debate. Ideas were operative for him. And he had two basic ideas. He had two agenda items in politics from the beginning of his career to the end. And they could be stated very simply, and they were stated very simply again and again. Number one, shrink government at home. Number two, defeat communism abroad. And everything else was simply an elaboration on that.
I want to play here a 1975 interview that he had with Johnny Carson. I think this was just after he'd left the governor's office, but before he was running for president. Let's listen to this, and we'll talk about it.
Intelligent people from both political parties are in the middle, conservatives and liberals, and they all seem to have different answers as to what is going wrong in the country. Some people say, well, let's let the government spend billions of dollars. And then some other people say, no, no more federal spending. Let's give the tax rebates. And the other intelligent people say, no tax rebates. We've got to do this and do that. So everybody is confused. How do you see the thing? How are we going to get out of this?
Well, Johnny, I think that one of the things is that people keep looking to government for the answer, and government's the problem. A moment ago, you asked, you know, about people and feeling not only confused, but low and down in America. First of all, the American people, if they would just take a little inventory and look around, you triple our troubles, and we're better off than any other people on earth. And we've asked so much of government, and we've gotten in the habit over the last 40 years of thinking that government has the answers. There's very little that government can do as efficiently and as economically as the people can do themselves. And if government would shut the doors and sneak away for about 3 weeks, we'd never miss them. Now, if the people
did
want to
anybody
be
you had in mind particularly?
No, I said this while I was in government.
Okay.
That is a 1975 interview on The Tonight Show between Ronald Reagan and then-Governor Ronald Reagan, former governor, and Johnny Carson. I'm speaking this hour with biographer H.W. Brands, whose new book is called Reagan, The Life. You hear that little exchange, and it sounds like the playbook for what would become the ideologies of the modern Republican Party, certainly the Tea Party today.
Ronald Reagan, in my interpretation, is one of the two most important presidents of the 20th century. The first is Franklin Roosevelt. The second is Ronald Reagan. And the reason that each one is so important is each one took a status quo and pushed it in a new direction. With Roosevelt, there had been this conservative status quo. Roosevelt became president during the Great Depression when the private sector was on life support, and Roosevelt and the large majority of Americans who elected him believed that there needed to be a stronger role for government. Government needed to be more robust to deal with the crises facing the United States. And that was the dominant thinking from the 1930s, essentially until Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. And Reagan took the view that, no, by this time, government had gotten too big. And government need to be shrunk, as Reagan said in that piece we just heard. If government would go away for 3 weeks, no one would notice. There was a working majority by the 1980s that said government needs to be smaller. And Reagan summarized it in a one-liner. He was a master of the political one-liners. When he says that government is not the solution, government's the problem. And that is the world that we have been living with pretty much ever since. Reagan remade the Republican Party, basically eliminated the moderate and liberal wing of the Republican Party and refashioned the Republican Party in his own image. We've been living with a Republican Party that's all conservative ever since Reagan. And the essence of that conservatism is government is the enemy. We have to shrink government. If we could make government go away, we'd all be better off. Now, there's a great irony in this, of course, especially for Reagan, but for every other Republican candidate. If you're so opposed to government, why are you running for a position in government? And Reagan used the one-liners as an approximation. Reagan was not an enemy of government. He thought that government had gotten too big. He didn't think government really should go away. He said there for a laugh to go away for 3 weeks. He didn't say go away forever. And I was speaking to a member of the Reagan administration who picked up on that, and he said, we were conservatives. We weren't anarchists. We didn't want to destroy government. We simply wanted to make government more efficient and smaller. And that was the essence of the Reagan message. And it's a reminder of sort of where we are today. From Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s until Ronald Reagan, new government programs, new federal programs came often and relatively easy. So if you look at the New Deal, a plethora of new programs. If you look at the Great Society of the 1960s, even more. Since Reagan, yeah, we do occasionally get new government programs, but they come rarely and they come with great difficulty. And maybe the best example of this is the fate of Obamacare, which is before the Supreme Court almost as we speak. And it's been struggling since it was passed in 2010. So what Reagan did essentially in American politics was change the nature of the conversation. And government and liberalism and the sort of pro-government liberalism has been on the defensive ever since. It was in the driver's seat. From FDR to Reagan. Since Reagan, it's been on its back foot and it's been trying to defending its turf.
What did Nancy Reagan see as her obligation to her husband? What did she need to do for him? And where would you place her on the spectrum between political asset and political liability?
Nancy Reagan had an agenda, but it was not a political agenda. It was a personal agenda. And the personal agenda was the success of her husband. It didn't really matter much to her where he invested his energies and ambitions. If he had decided that he wanted to go in the corporate world, she would have been as devoted in the pursuit of that success as she was when he went into politics. She also understood that he was not a particularly good judge of people, of the people who worked for him. He wasn't very good at picking out those people who had their own private agendas and those who were signed onto his agenda. So Nancy often felt that she was the one who had to protect him from the people around him who were self-interested, who didn't have the interests of either him or the country. As a result of this, she often ran afoul, or ran crosswise, with members of his administration, many of whom said, well, who in the world elected Nancy Reagan? But there is it's a very touching and intriguing relationship between Reagan and Nancy. And she is quite devoted to him, and he is devoted to her. In fact, they are to each other almost the entire emotional universe. Reagan's whole emotional energy was invested in Nancy. Now, some of this is a holdover from the fact that when he was a child, his mother was the rock of emotional support. His father was not. And so Nancy became kind of a surrogate mother. In fact, Reagan always called Nancy Mommy.
Which always has, in any human being, that always seems creepy to me.
Well, I mentioned this to my students, my undergraduates. They're 19 and 20-year-olds. And when I say, Nancy Reagan always called her husband Ronnie. Okay, no reaction. And he always called her Mommy. There's this universal, that's really weird. But so he was very devoted to her. She was very devoted to him. And sometimes this is simply touching. So when they're apart, in his diary, between entries about Mikhail Gorbachev and Tip O'Neill, he says, I'm counting the hours until mommy gets back. But there are other times when Nancy's interests and needs intrude on the realm of the president. The most striking, perhaps, and the one that ultimately became the most embarrassing for Reagan, was when Nancy was – it was discovered, it was publicized that Nancy had been consulting an astrologer for scheduling the president. Now, this came about, and the reason it happened was precisely because Reagan was so concerned for Nancy's welfare. After Reagan was nearly assassinated 5 weeks into his presidency, Nancy was utterly distraught. She knew that there were people who could kill her husband and that he was going to have to go out in public and they might shoot at him again. And she could not imagine her life going on without him. She lost weight. She couldn't eat. She couldn't sleep. She seemed to be just withering away. And Reagan and all of Nancy's associates and friends were really worried about her. So Nancy was talking one day on the telephone to Merv Griffin, whom she knew from Hollywood, who suggested there was a woman in California who might be able to provide her some help. And this woman was an astrologer. And this astrologer, when Nancy got to talk to her on the phone, said that, oh, yes, if you had asked me, I could have told you that March 30th, the day on which Reagan was shot, was a bad day for him. Now, Nancy Reagan was no dummy, and to have someone predict an event that had already happened, you'd have to be pretty gullible to fall for it. But she did. She really was so desperate. She was clinging to anything. And so she began sending Reagan's penciled-in schedule to Joan Quigley, who was the woman's name, to see, is this day bad? Is this day good for travel and for things like this? And Reagan did not believe in astrology, but he loved his wife. And he saw that it gave her some measure of comfort and gave her a little bit greater confidence that he wasn't going to get killed. He knew how embarrassing it could be if this ever got out, but he was willing to take the risk. And indeed, when the news did get out, it was horribly embarrassing. The Late Show comics made, great hay out of this, and people around the world, other leaders began scratching this. The leader of the free world, the most powerful man in the United States, can't fly to Reykjavik for a meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev on Wednesday because it's a bad day. He has to go on Thursday. This seemed very bizarre. But even when the news came out, I think Reagan concluded, if it made Nancy feel a little bit better, it was worth doing. So what do you make of this? I mean, here's a guy who on the one hand has this deep devotion to his wife. On the other hand, is doing things that the president of the United States maybe shouldn't be doing, at least not quite in that way.
Bill, when you've studied a lot of important figures throughout history, when you start to get into like the nitty-gritty details of their lives and look at them, and you're not necessarily providing psychological analysis, but as a human, you have to think about these things. Does it comfort you or discomfort you to think of how human all these people are that we're trusting with very important matters?
I tell you, it goes both ways, because on the comforting side, yeah, this person is a human being. And presumably has the same kind of cares about the future, about his children and grandchildren and so on, as the rest of us. On the other hand, given the tremendous responsibility and powers that reside with a president, for example, you would like to think that, okay, this person knows more, this person is smarter, this person is something, this person has the talents that are commensurate with the responsibilities. And I will tell you that having studied previous presidents, there are certain individuals who become president who shape the world, and you can see that there is some kind of commensurability between their unusual talents and their unusual accomplishments. And with somebody like Lyndon Johnson, a rough contemporary of Reagan, with Johnson you can see, first of all, he was a really bright guy. He went through college, no more than that, but he was just really bright. And people commented again and again how smart he was. He had this powerhouse of a brain. And he also had this driving ambition. You could look at the young Lyndon Johnson, and you could say, this guy is going places. This guy's going to make his mark on the world. The striking thing to me about Ronald Reagan was, until he went into politics, nobody knew he had any political skills. No one would have said, this is the guy who's going to change the course of American history in the 1980s, as late as he was 53 when he first stepped into the political ring. And when he was 52, no one would have said, this guy is going to make his mark on the world. No, it looked like he had already had his chance, and he'd blown it. And all the good years of Ronald Reagan had gone by. He goes into politics, and all of a sudden there is – and this is one of the central parts of the Reagan story, but it's true with any American political leader. The secret is the connection between the president and the American people at that moment. And so Andrew Jackson was a hero in his day because the American political situation, political system, needed a leader like that. Abraham Lincoln came along at just the right moment. I mean, I'm not saying that there was anything predestined about it. The ones we remember successful are the ones who fit their moments. I'm often asked, what would Theodore Roosevelt, what would Franklin Roosevelt, what would Ronald Reagan do today? And the answer often is, I don't know, because I know why they were successful in their moment, but moments change.
I just had this thought that, like, what if we could play like presidential fantasy football, right? Like, what if you could put FDR, you know, in George Washington's place? It would be a really interesting thought exercise for historians and for regular people.
Well, given where we are in the political cycle, I've often been asked on this book tour, so what can the candidates learn from Ronald Reagan? Specifically, what can the Republican candidates learn from Ronald Reagan? Or could Reagan get elected today? I mean, that's the question.
Was he actually more liberal than today's Republicans?
And my answer to could he get elected today is yes, if he hadn't already been elected. Because Reagan as a candidate was as conservative as any of the Republicans today. That's Reagan the candidate. In fact, Reagan gave essentially one speech his entire career. His political career lasted 25 years, from 1964 when he first came onto the scene and 1989 when he left the White House. And it was basically the same speech. And it was, we need to shrink government at home. We need to defeat communism abroad. And he elaborated in various forms on that. But in his speeches, when he was a candidate, he was 100% conservative. It's only after he became governor first and then president that he demonstrated that when you're governing, you have to modify things a little bit. So candidate Reagan would fare very well as long as he hadn't already been president, and so that people couldn't use that presidential record against him in the primaries.
We're speaking with historian H.W. Brands. He's Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at UT Austin. His new book is called Reagan, The Life. He's in town to speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church as part of the Authors Live Speaker Series. We'll be back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. Join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
In the 1950s, Khrushchev predicted, "We will bury you." But in the West today, we see a free world that has achieved a level of prosperity and well-being unprecedented in all human history. In the communist world, we see failure. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
That was Ronald Reagan talking at the Brandenburg Gate in what was then West Berlin, June 12th, 1987. My guest is his newest biographer, H.W. Brands, who is a chair in history at the University of Texas at Austin. The new book is called Reagan, The Life. H.W. Brands will speak tonight at 7 at Highland Park United Methodist Church. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. It's still a moving speech. It belies, Bill, the relationship that he had built with this person he spoke to as if they were strangers.
Well, in fact, Gorbachev was really annoyed at that speech by Reagan because they had begun to develop a personal relationship. Several months earlier, they had met at Reykjavik in Iceland for two long days of nose-to-nose, toe-to-toe negotiation over basically the fate of the world. They were trying to eliminate the nuclear arsenals of the superpowers, and they came very close. And one of the reasons they came so close was that Reagan and Gorbachev, sort of against all odds, had developed a close working understanding, and they even became something approaching friends. So when Reagan steps out on stage in Berlin and throws down the gauntlet this way, Gorbachev thought that Reagan was simply grandstanding. And plenty of people thought that Reagan was engaged in a kind of political mischief that would simply make things worse, because Gorbachev was engaged in reform in the Soviet Union, but he knew that the greatest threat to reform was his own right wing. And if the president of the United States started to dance on the Berlin Wall, then there would be the risk of a right-wing coup in the Soviet Union.
He's basically baiting the Soviet right.
Exactly, which is exactly what happened. The coup failed, and it was after Reagan left office. But it was a speech that energized those people in Eastern Europe who were thinking this is exactly what the United States should be calling for. This is exactly what we want. Now, the speech itself had no immediate effect. In fact, the Soviet Union dismissed it as this kind of political ploy. And people in West Germany, in fact, the West German government didn't like the speech at all. The speech itself belies the impression a lot of people had that Reagan was simply an actor who read lines written for him by somebody else. Reagan, in fact, as president, wrote more of his own lines than any president since Woodrow Wilson, who wrote all of his own speeches. And that line, "Tear down this wall," was one that Reagan wrote. And then the speech, of course, had to be vetted by the diplomats, by the State Department and so on. Went to the State Department. They said, you got to take this out. This is too provocative. And they said, take it out. Reagan said, put it back in. They sent it to somebody else. They said, take it out. Reagan said, put it back in. The lines stay in. This is probably the most memorable line that Reagan uttered as president. And it's one that resonated around Eastern Europe. Now, the speech itself did not bring down the wall. But when the wall came down just 15 months later, then a lot of people looked to that, and many of the people in Eastern Europe said that provided us the inspiration that gave us the confidence to take the steps that we did. So Reagan didn't cause the Soviet Union and communism in Europe to dissolve. He didn't do that by himself. He had a lot of help. But it was his voice that gave word to the view that Reagan believed, that many people in Eastern Europe aspired to, and that's the one that people remember.
Why was he the guy who could finally come out and be committed to nuclear disarmament and to détente with the Soviets?
Well, probably because it's in American politics, it's the story of it takes a Richard Nixon to go to China.
Right.
You have to be the one who has demonstrated that you have the tough position against the communists before you can negotiate with the communists. Now, in fact, there are a lot of people who look at Reagan and see it's the term is often Reagan reversal. So there's one Reagan in the first term, and then there's another Reagan in the second term. The Reagan in the first term is the one who builds up the American arsenal, who sounds like a warmonger. Then the Reagan of the second term is the one who goes to Reykjavik to talk about eliminating nuclear weapons and signs the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, and sets the stage for the drastic reduction of the arsenals of the superpowers. In fact, in this case, there were not two Reagans. Reagan, from the time he was governor of California, when he was young, he believed that nuclear weapons were essentially immoral in the sense that the populations of the world must not be held hostage to the rationality of the leaders, and something needs to be done to get rid of them. But Reagan believed that the only way the United States could get the Soviet Union to negotiate in good faith was to make clear that the Soviets could not beat the United States in an arms race. Now, some of this goes back to Reagan's days as president of the Screen Actors Guild, when he would negotiate with the studios, the Hollywood studios. And he understood that sometimes you have to get the attention of the other side by taking a strong position. So that's what the arms buildup of Reagan's first term was all about. It was never about using those weapons to fight a war. It was to demonstrate to the Russians they couldn't beat the United States without a war. And so once he had made the point, and crucially, once the Soviet leadership of Leonid Brezhnev, Konstantin Chernenko, Yuri Andropov, have given way to this new guy, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was interested in reform. Finally, Reagan had somebody he could talk to. He had been tried to talk to those previous leaders, but got no response. With Gorbachev, there was somebody he could talk to. But he also had at his back the fact that the United States had made the point, you're not going to spend us into oblivion. You know, we can outspend you if necessary. Now come to the negotiating table and we can strike a deal, which is exactly what happened.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Robert in Dallas on the phone. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Following up on the relationship with the Soviet Union, in the last couple of weeks, there was an episode of 60 Minutes where they interviewed a former high-ranking Soviet spy who said one of the few things that really scared the Soviets was Ronald Reagan, because they thought he was really of a mind to push the nuclear button. I don't know if your research confirmed that or discounted that, or does that what your comment is on that?
It's a really good question, and there's a striking moment in Reagan's presidency. It's about 3 years in when he comes to the realization that the Soviet Union might actually be afraid of the United States. And for Reagan, this was something of an epiphany, because Reagan knew that he was never going to launch a nuclear war, despite the fact that some of the people around him sometimes talked about how a nuclear war was winnable. But Reagan knew in his own heart that he wasn't going to start a nuclear war, and he believed that no American president would ever do that, because the United States is this fundamentally moral and good country. And so he often thought that when the Soviets talked about their fear of the United States, they were just scoring political points. But he gradually came to realize that, well, with all of these weapons that the Americans are building, and with the talk of some people around the president, if not the president himself, about maybe we could use them, well, maybe the Russians really did have something to be afraid of. And in his memoir, he talks about this. And he says, I realized for the first time that they might actually fear us. And as a historian of presidents and international affairs, I want to just slap my forehead and say, well, duh. You know, if the other side has thousands of nuclear weapons aimed at you, yeah, you might have reason to be afraid. But this was one of the first steps that caused Reagan to sort of humanize the other side. And when Reagan could put a face, could put a personality into the individuals he's talking about on the other side, then it opened up possibilities. Now, sometimes it worked for the good. Sometimes it worked for the not so good. So Reagan was able to negotiate arms control with Mikhail Gorbachev because he got to know Mikhail Gorbachev and he could develop this personal relationship. Sometimes it worked not so positively. One of the reasons that Reagan got tangled up in the Iran-Contra scandal was that Reagan got to know personally the families of the American hostages held in Lebanon. And through the families, he got to know them. And so Reagan would begin almost every morning's briefing when the CIA would come around and say, okay, this is what's going on. He would say, have we made any progress toward releasing the hostages? He probably got too personally involved on that in that area. In his personal relationship with Gorbachev, it was pretty much all to the good.
So many people have wondered over the years whether there were signs, early signs of Reagan's later Alzheimer's and dementia while he was still in the White House. You have an interesting story in this book that seems to show that the symptoms really were triggered by a horseback riding accident he had in the summer of 1989 after he had left the White House.
That was Nancy Reagan's interpretation of how things turned out. And it might be entirely sincere, and that's all there is to it. On the other hand, Nancy might very well have wanted to say that this entirely came about after he left the White House. There were people who observed Reagan in the White House who said, well, they weren't using the word Alzheimer's at that point, but they were noticing that this guy is not the same person he was when he was a younger man. Well, nobody at 75 is the same person they were at 45. But for example, in the 1984 campaign, when Reagan was running against Walter Mondale, there were two debates. And in the first debate, Reagan was uncharacteristically awkward and flustered. Reagan, he was an old actor. He could memorize lines. He fumbled his closing speech. He got lost and he couldn't remember what he was supposed to say. And he seemed really flustered. He seemed really old. The next day, the Wall Street Journal, a very Republican-friendly newspaper, had a big headline that said, "Is Reagan too old to be president?" Ron Reagan, Reagan's son, later said that he thought that that's when the first signs of dementia were becoming evident. John Poindexter, who is Reagan's national security advisor, when I was talking to him about the book, he said that one of the reasons he thinks that the Iran-Contra affair developed the way it did was that Reagan was not the master of detail. He'd never been a master of detail, but he was even looser on detail than he'd been. And this was 1985 and 1986. Now, for my purposes, I don't use the word Alzheimer's until Reagan and Nancy Reagan used the word. Because in the first place, it's impossible to diagnose definitively. I'm not a doctor. But I do demonstrate that Reagan was slowing down by the time he left the White House. Now, he was still capable of really good performances. In 1986, the end of 1986, he goes to Reykjavik and he negotiates with Gorbachev. And I've had access to the transcripts of the meetings. And he was fully the match for Gorbachev. He was 20 years younger than he was. And so Reagan was really good. And he could do it for 36 hours. He couldn't sustain it, though. As a younger man, he had more energy. So he was slowing down. Did that disqualify him to be president? No. There's nothing you can point to that said, boy, if we really knew, he should have taken the 25th Amendment and left the White House.
But a few years later, when he was called to testify, you reproduce it's really cringeworthy. And no matter what you think about him politically, it causes one to pity him at the state that he was in at that point.
Yes. So the Iran-Contra scandal gave rise to various investigations and ultimately prosecutions, and Reagan, as president, was asked to testify in some of these. And 2 years after he left the White House, he was giving a deposition in one of the cases. And he was asked a series of questions about, so what did you know and when did you know it? And it became apparent that he could not remember much at all. In something like 80 or 90 questions, he had to answer, I don't remember, I can't recall, I don't know. And some of this was really basic stuff like, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that point? You know, this is his right-hand military advisor. But the worst came when he could not remember who Michael Deaver was. Michael Deaver was a close personal friend, the longest-serving Californian who joined Reagan in the White House. And you know, one can imagine what Michael Deaver must have thought of this. But at the end of this deposition, Reagan says something, and I repeat the line in the book precisely because it's so touching, but it's also kind of scary. Here's this guy not that long out of the White House who says, it's like I was never president at all. That part of his memory is just gone.
Could we use another Reagan, another person who inspired us to that extent? And is that impossible now, given the way politics has changed in this country?
It would be harder today, I think, because in large part because the media has become so splintered. Franklin Roosevelt was the master of radio. And if you mastered radio in the 1930s, you could control the political discourse. Reagan mastered television in the 1970s and 1980s. And if you could command TV, you could command the attention of the country. It's not at all clear that any single medium, that any individual could rivet the attention of the country the way that Reagan did. But there is a huge role for vision. Americans like to believe that things are going to get better. And there's plenty of reason to think that things are going to get better, that the end is not nigh. But if Reagan... if somebody like Reagan could come along, especially on the conservative side, one fundamental secret of Reagan's success was he was an optimistic conservative. That's a bit of an oxymoron. Conservatives tend to be pessimists. But Reagan took the conservative message that appeals to lots of people and put a friendly face on it. If somebody could do that today, then they could probably be the next president of the United States.
H.W. Brands is professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, Reagan, The Life. Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.